We do want to see a less crowded curriculum, particularly in the primary school years. The review finds that there's a great deal of breadth, but not nearly enough depth in areas like, for example, literacy and numeracy.
That's Christopher Pyne, the Federal Minister for Education, launching the review of the national curriculum and the government's response to that. So this review is a pretty hefty document. It's about 300 pages. It's a big thing. And it was compiled after gathering lots of submissions and consultations and so on. And if Christopher Pyne is able to sell it at the Education Council of State and Territory Education Ministers in a few weeks' time, this will replace the previous national plan, which had barely been announced before there was a change of government. So the authors of this review say that they're slimming down an overcrowded curriculum and that they've designed it to be more teacher-friendly, more pupil-friendly, more parent-friendly. The review says that the arts are crucial and that they should not be an ancillary or add-on component. So let's look at the detail of what this review recommends and what does it mean for Australian school children and for their teachers and their parents, I guess. Now, we invited Dr. Kevin Donnelly, who's one of the key authors of the review, to come along to the show today, but he declined, saying he couldn't discuss it until after the state's meeting in December. But joining us now is Robin Ewing, who is a professor of teacher education and the arts. She's also acting pro-dean at the University of Sydney, and she joins us right now. Hi, Robin.
Good morning, Michael.
Now, for those who came in late, perhaps we better explain ever so briefly what the national curriculum is.
Yes, well, the national curriculum is an attempt by the Rudd government and subsequent governments to bring us all into line with one intended curriculum in each of the different key learning areas: English, math, science, geography, history, the arts, etc.
So, of course, education is ultimately a state matter.
Well, exactly.
So you have the states deciding what will be taught. But this is an attempt to bring about a kind of national coherence or national continuity between one state and another.
Yes.
Okay, so we had this curriculum that was set up. It was proposed, not implemented yet. The Liberals came in. They set up this review, which has now been published. In brief, what does it say about the place of arts education in this broader national curriculum?
Well, while it definitely does agree that the arts are very important in the curriculum, and it does address the need for more professional learning for teachers in the arts and more resourcing needed, on the other hand, it actually limits what has been set up to date. So, to date, we have a national arts curriculum that looks at the five different art forms, distinct in their own right, with their own skills and knowledges, understandings, etc. Distinct but interrelated.
I'll just cut in on you, Robin. So,
sure.
So the original plan was for the kids actually to study dance, drama,
yes,
visual arts,
music
and media arts. These are all going to be part of the curriculum. Now,
critics
say, wow, that sounds like terrific in theory, but that's very, very ambitious. How are you going to put all that into a curriculum? Perhaps we should just focus on one or two arts, make them the essential ones, and then give students who want to the opportunity to explore more broadly.
Well, that's exactly right. They actually are recommending in their review that music and art, visual art, be core, and that the other art forms be electives. And I think that is a very retrograde step, because I think all children should be entitled to have the quality experiences in all art forms. And I'd also like to make the point that literature and the literary arts should also always be seen as part of the arts. They're not in the arts document. They have, of course, an important role in English. But the important thing is about, I think, bringing all of these together in relevant and meaningful ways, not in silos. And I think that would go some way to not thinking about ever crowding the curriculum out.
There are two issues here, it seems to me, Robin. One is, do we want to provide training in all the arts for kids, or can we limit them in some way to make the curriculum more manageable? And you've put your view there. The other concern that's around is whether this review that the Liberals commissioned was a return to the culture wars, whether we were now going to have a situation in which there was a Labor curriculum loaded with Labor-type values that was being replaced by a Liberal curriculum loaded with Liberal-type values, and this football could just go back and forward forever. Now, as you read the review, is it as politically charged as some people were apprehensive it would be?
No, in a sense, I don't think it's as politically charged as it is conservatively or traditionally charged, in a sense. So it makes a number of references to the need to go back to the basics, for example, and to concentrate on literacy and numeracy in the first years of schooling. And I guess my concern about that is that the arts are indeed very much part of the basics. They are part of who we are as human beings. We're born with that desire to sing and dance and play and paint and draw, etc. And I think it's also very linked to who we are as creative individuals. To cut that off and to say, well, we're just going to concentrate on this first, is, I think, not looking at the research that talks very much about how important the processes that you engage in when you engage in any of the art forms, and that's not to take away from what I said earlier about them being distinct, but they all have, you know, features like play, design, experimentation, exploration, provocation, etc.
So you're saying when we go into a junior class, we want to see kids painting and dancing and being creative, not sitting down grimly learning to add up and spell.
Well, they will still learn to add up and spell. I'm saying that these are other forms of making meaning. So what I'm really saying is that there are other forms of literacies, and that we shouldn't limit what we think literacy is to, you know, phonics, spelling. They're important, but they're only part of the story. It's also being able to understand in a deep and meaningful way what the story is about. And sometimes things like drama and dance will help us unpack that in a way that simply reading something can't.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're looking at the review of the national curriculum, that is the Liberals' response to the Labor plan. And Robin Ewing is with me, who's Professor of Teacher Education and the Arts, and she's also Acting Pro-Dean at the University of Sydney. The review makes the point that drama and dance require resources that many schools simply don't have, that you know, that if you're a generalised teacher, you can't just go in and run a drama class or teach kids to dance, that realistically those resources just aren't there. So you would be setting up schools to fail if you required them all to teach drama and to teach dance.
Well, I'm afraid we're already failing, Michael. There's been two national reviews of the way that both music and visual arts are taught in schools. And while we have cutting-edge state-of-the-art at some schools, there is a dearth in others, and that's partly because over time we have provided less and less resourcing and professional learning for teachers, early childhood to primary and secondary teachers in the other areas. Certainly some secondary teachers, if they're going to be teaching the arts, have those specialisations. But the other thing is, we're not suggesting that everyone will become an expert in these areas. What we're suggesting is that they will be able to introduce and scaffold and guide children to explore these different art forms. But you can't do that unless you have the professional learning and the resources to do it. Just to say, well, we're going to cut it because it's going to cost, is a really, again, very backward way of looking at things, when we know from the research that those children who engage in quality arts experiences will, one, be much more socially and emotionally well, but also that they will do much better academically. Those children in the States who've been followed into adulthood are also much more well-adjusted human beings who engage much more in community service. So even if you look at the economic side of things, you must see that investing in professional learning for teachers, resources in the arts, is a way forward for us all. It's win-win.
Robin, we're talking though as though there isn't going to be any art. There is going to be art, and there's going to be music, and there's going to be visual art, and that's going to be a compulsory part of the curriculum. Now,
well, you see, I think that's great that that's going to be there, but I don't think that's enough. My own area is literature and drama, and there's a huge amount of work done on how the dramatic processes and walking in other people's shoes, etc., can really help children develop, a whole range of understandings that they wouldn't get. So I think it's really sad if we pit one art form against another. I want to make the argument very strongly that all of the art forms need to be there in their own right and not just set privilege two and say, oh, the others can be electives.
But it is a step forward. I mean, look, it's over 20 years since I was a school teacher, but I can remember going into a school teacher the first time I went to a high school to teach, and I was asked to take a music class, and really the music room was just a classroom with a cupboard that had a few broken tambourines in it. I mean,
music and visual arts have always been compulsory, Michael.
Yes.
That's my point. The others need to have that entitlement as well. Since I've been a teacher, which is a long time.
So you're saying this is not...
We're always mandated, so that's no different to what we had before.
Okay, so it's not an advance.
No, okay. It's going backwards.
I see. All right, so let's be clear about what year levels we're talking about. In the current system, in the review as it now stands,
yes.
At what year levels will these will music and visual art be compulsory, and what options will be available under the review as it now stands?
Well, the review recommendations suggest that core visual arts and music be introduced from year three. That it's saying that certainly those other art forms might be part of what's happening in foundation to year two, but they'll be introduced as core in year three.
Okay.
You know what happens when you say, well, these things are core and these things are elective. The elective things often get left out.
Yes, and if you don't manage it properly, the elective things end up being the things that you send the kids to who aren't good at
That's
the
right.
central academy.
Can I also make the point that we also know that those children from more socioeconomic affluent backgrounds will still have extracurricular arts experiences because their parents will be able to afford it. But even though we know how important it is for all children, unless we introduce all of those things to children at school, they won't necessarily have those experiences in the same way. So again, they will be, I think, disadvantaged by not having those opportunities.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Michael.
Professor Robin Ewing talking to us there on Books and Arts Daily about the new curriculum. Well, let's continue that discussion in just a moment. Yes, let's open up the discussion now. We'll focus a little more, actually, at what role arts organisations will have in making this new curriculum a reality. And I thought we'd look at theatre this morning. Some children will choose theatre studies as a subject at senior secondary school because it will be an option. But where does that leave children who don't actually study theatre? Now, a provocative paper suggests that theatre companies might have to step in here, but I wonder whether they're up to the task. And I think the authors are taking the view that there are some question marks over that readiness of the theatre companies to do this job. With me are Meg Upton, who's an arts educator consultant and researcher. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
And Naomi Edwards is assistant director of Opera Australia. She's an arts educator as well.
Oh, good morning, Michael.
And they've written a platform paper. This is this regular series that's published by Currency House. It comes out, I think, once every 3 months. They're fantastic. All sorts of issues are debated. So this one's all about education and the arts. It's called Creativity and the Promised New Order. So, Meg, you claim that most performing arts companies don't take their education programs anywhere as seriously as they could. What's wrong?
They're very much, if I follow on from Robin's comment, there's an ancillary nature to education programs that I think exists in theatre companies. So as arts tends to be ancillary to education, I feel that education tends to be ancillary to arts organisations.
Well, you can understand why. They've got their hands full putting on the latest production by Joanna Murray Smith or...
Hanny Rayson, perhaps.
Well, okay. Or, or a new play by, a new version of something from the Greeks. But so you can understand why the kids would be a secondary thing. Because
no, I don't. No, don't? I don't understand that at all. I don't understand why the act of programming a work doesn't automatically consider the young people who are going to be potentially being in that building and what their experience is going to be.
Hmm. Naomi?
I agree. I think that there's a real thought in programming that focuses on a particular idea of who a demographic might be and without embracing from a programming point of view, but then also a way of structuring education programs to bring young people into the work that is programmed.
You know, the line that sticks with me from this paper is this idea that, no, we're not preparing the audience of the future, which is, I'm afraid, is what I've always said. We've got to create lay the groundwork for the audience of the future. But you make the point, no, the kids are the audience of now.
Well, that works on the assumption that subscribers are subscribers and will always be the age that they currently are.
Extremely elderly.
And they fall asleep.
When in actual fact, you know, a theatre is open to all age groups, and some of the most exciting work in the world at the moment is in infant theatre.
Of course, it's so obvious once you say it. Yes. I feel ashamed that I've ever said we should be cultivating the audience of the future. We've got to get the kids in right now.
Unfortunately, though, Michael, that's how I think many theatre companies or producing companies think, is that we are bring them in, give them an arts experience, and then we'll have our audiences of the future.
Not anymore. We've changed their mind.
Too simplistic.
They're all crowded around their radios as they are every morning listening to Books and Arts Daily.
If it was only that easy, Michael. Yeah.
They're at the STC and the MTC and over there at Swan and Black Swan. They're all listening, taking notes. Don't worry about that.
Please.
So are you detecting any apprehensiveness among the theatre companies about these changes?
In changes in the arts curriculum?
Yeah.
Jimmy, you know, to be honest, I notice in the actual review, the 13 pages or the 10 pages devoted to the arts, that there's been submissions from major performing arts groups. And one of the things that I have a concern about is I'm waiting for some really strident voices from the arts and cultural community to be speaking. If we take a music example, Richard Gill has been an advocate and lobbyist for music education in this country for a very long time. And I'm really waiting for our cultural leaders to step up and say, hang on a sec.
And another generation, because Richard Gill's getting on a bit.
Well, he is, and he's, you know, he's hopefully passing the baton to others. But, yeah, absolutely, where are both our young and our emerging, our mid and our late career?
Not that
cultures.
We're implying, Richard, that you should give up.
Yes, we do love Richard.
Hang on forever, as far as I'm
concerned. But where are they, and where are their voices in this debate?
Yeah. So what happens in the theatre company? Classically, what happens in providing experiences for children? What do they do?
I think it depends on the vision of that particular education department. A very easy solution is providing framing devices for the program that sits. So whether you turn up and have some kind of introductory talk before you see a major production, there's teacher notes prepared, there's quite a sort of... but on the other hand, there's programs that actually use the skills and talents of artists, be they actors or designers, to further other agendas. And I point to something like school drama run through the Sydney Theatre Company, which is sending actors into primary schools to help teachers teach literacy through drama processes.
When you're at school, it is massively exciting when a top-class actor comes to your school, or actually artist in any form.
Yep.
I mean, I can remember my life really being changed by hearing a man who was a world-class recorder player. Mm-hmm. As simple as that, coming to our school. Because, you know, your kids play in the recorder, they go, ooh, 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 ooh. It sounds like that. And suddenly here comes this man who can play like a god.
Yep.
And you think, oh, my Lord, that little wooden tube, which are all making these horrible noises where they can sound ethereal.
Mm. And I think that's the thing for me, is that the moments that can change a child's life are instant. They can be the tiniest experience, and they are indelible. So I think that, coming back to your question about what are theatre companies doing, I think they underestimate how much impact they can actually have in the programs that they run and the value of them.
Mm. And both in an in-school incursion context, but we really champion the opening of the door, the huge symbolic gestures that we want theatre companies to make in a much broader way, come into our building, come into our company and participate in the art-making that we're engaging in.
But as we know, the issue always is who's going to pay for it.
You're absolutely right, and there's a bottom line, and theatre is also a commercial enterprise, and it needs to make money, and it needs to exist, and it needs to. But I think the companies that are, if I look at MTC, who actively went after a large endowment, so they've now got a great partnership going with the Crown Resort, but they did that totally to tether that money to an education program and to develop their engagement with that sector. So it's very purposeful, And it is about saying this is an investment not only for us as an arts organisation, but for the people who are putting up the money, and saying this is an investment in the future of the not only the theatre companies and the art form itself, but in the future of lots and lots and lots of young Australians.
So that's a good news story.
It's a great news story. And that's, I suppose, if you're going for money, what are you going for? And what's it going to be applied to within the company? So I think those are some questions that I think are really big ones for theatre companies.
Mm. Now, Naomi, I know that you're in rehearsal at the moment with Opera Australia. You're assistant director presenting Don Pasquale, mm-hmm. which is Donizetti's comedy about a 19th century Roman man who's trying to arrange a marriage for his nephew. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So we're presenting this to a primary school audience.
No, we're not. My other work with Opera Australia is directing the school's company work, which is sending shortened versions of operas out into primary schools, and they reach about 80,000 children a year. Yes, I work across main stage theatre and
I see. Arts I've got your two
stuff.
Projects muddled. So what are you presenting to? So I see. I thought it was an inappropriate story.
Oh, no, it's good. No, well, that's actually the challenge of how you, with inside the Opera Australia program, it's finding a way to bring the canon, the sort of seminal works to a primary school audience. Most recently, I've done an adaptation of La Cenerentola, the Cinderella story, and that's toured Victorian schools this year and we're toured New South Wales schools next year.
Right. All right. So that's about bringing opera to kids, and it's saying opera is not a scary, old-fashioned art form. It's something you can relate to.
Absolutely. And about for most children, it'll be the first time that they've heard live performance in the first instance, and particularly in opera, hearing an unamplified voice coming back to your recorder.
And is there resistance among children to opera? Because it is seen as a sort of funny, old-fashioned kind of art form.
They don't know that yet.
Oh,
they don't have those barriers yet. And it's only later on that the notions of class and elitism kicks in around it. If you can get a five-year-old singing Figaro in the playground, which we manage to do quite regularly, then all of those barriers are dissolved before they even exist.
Well, this is sounding good.
Yeah. Mm. Which is why we wrote the paper, because we can see what is, like, as I freelance across a range of companies, as does Meg, and we can see the potentials, and I guess what we're arguing for in the paper, that at a management and structural level, the theatre companies see that and back it.
So let's workshop a few other programs, a few other events that an education program in theatre could provide. Mm. What would they look like?
I guess one of the things that I think, if I go back to the curriculum review, I'm sorry, and the way they talk about arts as an education, they talk about it in terms of bringing out artists. But arts education is not all about that. So it's also about learning to be an audience, because we all do need to learn to be an audience. For me, the best programs are those that, yes, go out to schools and do and have children singing opera, and I think that's brilliant. And I think adults.
So drawing a contrast between the making of theatre.
Yeah, the making of theatre.
And then the looking at
and
theatre.
And the looking at theatre. And they go together. And so, good. For example, there are programs running in some companies, both within this country and internationally, where young people come in and they're treated as art makers and they engage in the art making process. They make theatrical work and they present it in that building. And then they are, I suppose, honoured by that company as being art makers of now, which, of course, is an engagement process in the work that the company itself is probably making. So it's about honouring and valuing young people as arts makers. And I think you also get amazing audiences from that as well, because the kids become savvy and switched on. They engage. They invest. In fact, I think when I sit in young audiences of young people who I know have had really great, strong arts education, they are so much more active, involved, invested audiences than subscribers are.
Yes.
I'm sorry, subscribers.
In fact, I mean, just to end on a personal note, I guess the fact that I did drama at school and I did music at school, I didn't end up as an actor or as a professional musician, but I enjoy going to those things because I've seen it from the inside. So it's learning how to be an audience. It's an important point to make. Look, thank you for both coming in. It's a terrific paper. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It deals with all sorts of very meaty issues, and we touched on some of them here. Meg Upton and Naomi Edwards. And if you're in Melbourne, there'll be a launch of their Currency House platform paper. It's number 41. Jeepers creepers, 41. one they've produced. It's called Education and the Arts, Creativity in the Promised New Order. And there'll be a public debate, which I expect will be very vigorous. Now, this is at the Malthouse this coming Wednesday at 6:45. That's a quarter to seven. But you have to book.
5:45.
Oh, 5:45. Okay, 5:45, a quarter to six. But you do have to book for that. Don't just roll up. And
it's sold out.
Oh, it's sold out.
But I'm sure people can come.
All right. You'll have to talk to people about how good it was afterwards.
Particularly anyone under 18. Come along.
Yes, please.
We have to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michael. Bye.
Across Australia, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart.